a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me once again today. We're going to be talking with Stephen Gutowski of The Reload here in just a matter of moments about... I'd love to say that this is assured of passage, but given the numbers in Congress, I don't know that anything is assured of passage this year. The national, it used to be called the National Right to Carry Reciprocity Act. It has a slightly different name this year and a slightly slightly different language, too, as we'll get into with Stephen Gutowski. So what are the odds that we will see some improvement and maybe folks in Oklahoma or Texas or the state of Virginia could soon be able to carry in places like California or New York or New Jersey? Again, why is our right to keep and bear arms the only right that stops at the state line? And how on earth can the Second Amendment not be a second-class right when that is the case? So let's get into it with Stephen Gutowski from The Reload. Take a look and a listen. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us on the program today. It's good to see you again.
Yes, it's good to see you too, Cam.
All right. So, you know, I just got back to work this week. And I, now I'm trying to play catch up on like everything that happened in the, you know, 5 weeks or so that I was away. One of the things that that dropped in my absence was this kind of new and revised right to carry reciprocity bill. Right. We've seen this introduced by Representative Richard Hudson for, gosh, it's got to be close to 10 years now, right?
Yeah. But this is definitely a new iteration of it.
It is. It's got a new title, the Constitutional Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act. At least that's what it's called in the Senate. Senator Tom Tillis and 43 other Senate Republicans are already on board with this bill. Have you had a chance to take a look? Have we even seen, is the text available to look at this point?
Yeah. The text is out there and it does shift things a little bit. And in kind of an interesting way, I would say I'm going to have Rep Hudson on my show to do an interview and I'll probably ask him a little bit about this. But, you know, this is a bill, as you said, it's been around for 10 years. It's one of the top priorities of the gun rights movement in that time and just hasn't really gotten very close to passage, mainly because of the Senate and needing 60 votes there, and it'll probably face the exact same hurdle this time around. But they're sort of changing, maybe adapting it to kind of the current atmosphere, because, you know, when 10 years ago you didn't have that many constitutional carry states, now it's the majority of states, and most of those states are Republican states, obviously. And so Hudson has kind of updated this to include language that requires all states to recognize people from constitutional carry states as without requiring them to get a permit to allow them to carry along the same lines as what constitutional carry requires in their home state. So basically just you have to be an adult and you have to not have a disqualifying criminal or mental health record, right? So if you can legally possess the handgun, you can legally carry it. And so that's kind of an interesting update, right? Especially in the sense that it doesn't go full bore into requiring constitutional or permitless carry everywhere, but it kind of makes it so that people who already live in constitutional carry states can carry anywhere without a permit. It's kind of fascinating.
It is kind of fascinating. I'm sure, you know, again, you can hear the objections from the Democrats in these states that that do not have constitutional carry. And just from a practical standpoint, I mean, it seems like a real reach, right? It's just from a pragmatic standpoint, a person who lives in Texas, they travel to California. Let's use our friend Kurt Schlichter, who used to live in California, could not get a May issue permit in California. Now Kurt's in the Lone Star State. If Kurt were to go back to California, he would not have to have a Texas permit, right? Because Texas is a constitutional carry state. So even though a California resident is facing, you know, a year-long delay, right, in obtaining a permit if you live in L.A., you're paying $1,000 or more for your concealed carry permit. Folks in, 29 states could travel to California and just simply carry under this bill. right?
That's my understanding. Yeah. Reading the text, that's what it appears to do. And it, to me, it's actually the other way, sort of an odd half measure the other way, right? Like if you're just going to allow people in constitutional carry states to carry anywhere without a permit, why not just make constitutional carry or permitless carry the federal, standard that these states can't enact their own permitting requirements? That would seem to be more in line. I mean, this is something that, as you said, in this form, and honestly, even if you got rid of this particular provision, it's very unlikely to pass anyway. But in this form, especially, it feels more like a messaging, like you're trying to put forward, here's what we think the law should be, even if it's not going to practically make it through. And so why not just go full bore and say, we're just going to have permitless carry as the law of the land?
I hope that you pose that question to Representative Hudson, because you're right. That does seem to be the simplest exercise here, right? Because, I mean, I guess you could say, well, we're making a nod at least to state authority, but you're really not. If a state like California is not able to not only block non-residents from carrying, but again, folks could carry without a permit, depending on where they live, if they visit California. This isn't a state's rights argument, right? Why not just simplify things and say, you know what? The Second Amendment doesn't talk about the right to bear arms with a permit or a license. It just simply talks about the right to keep and bear. That's what we want to recognize as the federal government, and that should be the standard. If you can legally own a gun, you can legally carry it. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose under this, you'd still have the ability at the state level to restrict where you can carry, because you'd still have to comply with those aspects of a concealed carry law. It just affects the permitting and recognizing. Yeah, obviously, this was the original intent of this back when they first began the National Reciprocity Bill was just to make states recognize each other's permits, which a lot of, you run into the same problem in that a lot of Democratic states don't want to recognize other states' permits because they don't think that their standard for permitting is high enough. And obviously back when before Bruin, most of those deep blue states had a permitting system that people couldn't realistically get through, the vast majority of people. So it was just a way of reducing carry. Interestingly though, under this, even though the permitting process would be sort of short-circuited in those states, at least for people who don't live there, the real challenge now in deep blue states is not the permit, not getting the permit anymore. It's the gun-free zones that they have created in a much broader way than they used to as a response to the Bruin ruling. So this doesn't deal with that as far as I've seen in the text. So, it's kind of an interesting update. Like, it's definitely trying to move the legislation that's been around for a while closer to where the political reality on the Republican side is. Most Republicans now support constitutional carry or permitless carry. And so this bill is kind of updated to recognize that, I think. It's just in doing so, it kind of maybe is a bit of a half measure.
Or just overly complicated. Because again, I mean, if the goal is to recognize constitutional carry, there's a much easier way to do it than sort of, this seems to be like sort of a legislative Rube Goldberg machine, right? With maybe some unnecessary parts and pieces to accomplish, a goal that could be done in a much more simple fashion. And as you say, I don't want to be Mr. Negativity here, but it still takes 60 votes in the Senate to pass legislation, right? We've got 44 co-sponsors in the Senate for this bill as written. You're going to have, if you can get every Republican on board, you're still going to have to find, seven Democrat senators who would go along with this. I don't think that's possible with this makeup. Given the slim majorities in the House, I would like to think that the votes are there to pass this measure. But even with a simple majority, it's going to be really tough. And, a lot's going to depend on, I think, who would be in the chamber that day, how many open seats there might be, because we're going to be talking about really, really thin margins in the House for, basically anything that has the opportunity of passage.
Yeah, basically like a one vote margin once everything is settled with these cabinet picks. But, yeah, I mean, there's a possibility that Democrats maybe change their mind in the way that they're sort of pivoting on immigration a bit after, you know, losing the presidential election. We haven't really seen any signs of that yet, I'll say. There aren't any co-sponsors from the Democratic side in the Senate. And there's only one from last time I looked at the House bill. And that's Jared Golden from Maine, who's kind of a little bit all over the place on guns and just barely won re-election after endorsing an Sullivan's ban. So it's a little weird to endorse an Sullivan's ban and then go and endorse this bill too. But you know, you haven't seen an upswell, even of some of the more moderate Democrats. You really only have one right now. Now, maybe they will get some. It's just, you know, it's early stages here, but it probably will be an uphill battle even to just get it through the House, because you also have Republicans from states where this would basically invalidate their permitting process. And maybe that's something those Republicans support. I don't know for sure, but it's obviously a political risk to do that in a place like New York or some parts of California. So we'll see. Definitely the prospects are it's going to be a heavy lift to get it through even in the House.
It is. And, you know, so then, I mean, the other option when we were talking about this is the courts. And, you know, I don't even think we're really even in what I would consider the early stages of litigation here. You've got I guess you've got the case out of California, right, that's challenging the lack of non-resident permits and the unwillingness to recognize any out-of-state permits. But that's, again, very, very early on in litigation. The last I recall, a judge had basically ordered the state of California to come up with some system where non-residents could apply for a California permit.
Right.
How that works in practice, again, I don't know. You're going to have to find instructors who are willing to teach that course. Or maybe you have to fly to California to take the course and then, you know, go through all the rigmarole of obtaining a California carry permit. So, you know, this isn't something that the court system is going to be able to address and resolve in, let's say, the next 6 months, a year, or even 2 years, right? So, yeah,
not in that timeline, definitely.
Yeah,
it may resolve it. I've, you know, like you said, there was a California case, and even D.C. The reason I have a concealed carry permit in D.C., even though I live in Virginia, is because the city was ordered to issue non-resident permits. So that I could see courts doing as we move down the line here from Bruin, but it's probably going to take a long time for that to fully flesh out.
It really will. All right. Well, Steve, listen, it is good to see you, sir. I really do appreciate you coming on the program. I'm looking forward to seeing you again here soon. And when do you think you'll be talking with Representative Hudson? Will that be on the next Reload podcast?
Yes. It should be out on Sunday for Reload members and Monday for everybody else. So, I look forward to talking to him, not just about this bill, but, you know, obviously he introduces a bunch of bills, and maybe there's some, maybe he has some strategy in mind for trying to get some of these reforms through this really tight Congress. It's certainly, hopefully they have some plan and some process in mind to at least get some pro-gun reforms. Obviously, I think that's what a lot of people want to see out of a Republican-controlled Congress, even if, as we discussed, the numbers are tight. So it'll be interesting to hear from him. Hey, I'm glad to see you back. It's been rough, I know, and I think I speak for everybody watching that we're just glad to see you back here and hear your insight again.
I appreciate that very much, Steve, and again, I always love having you on the show. I would encourage folks, if you're not a member of thereload.com, go to thereload.com, sign up, become a member. Not only will you get early access to the podcast, but you'll be supporting Steve's fantastic segment of journalism. And I'm looking forward to hearing the podcast this weekend. Stephen Gutowski, thanks again, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
My thanks to Steve for joining us on the program today, and looking forward to having him back very soon. Tomorrow, by the way, we're going to be talking with Wisconsin gun store owner Chuck Lovelace about Governor Tony Evers' new Office of Gun Violence Prevention, Governor Evers' call for more gun control laws. I don't think that call is likely to be heeded by the Republican majority in Wisconsin. But I also want to talk with Chuck about the Wisconsin Gun Store Project. This is one of several endeavors around the country that talks about voluntary storage of firearms in a time of need. And I'll be perfectly honest with you. I have not felt that need since Missy passed away, but it is something that I'm very cognizant of, not just with me, but with my kids. And if I did believe that that was necessary, I absolutely would take advantage of programs like that. And so I want to destigmatize any stigma that might be attached to the idea that sometimes it might be a better idea to temporarily remove firearms from the home. So we're going to talk about that with the Chuck again. We're not talking about red flag laws. We're not talking about government intervention. We're talking about empowering gun owners to make that decision for themselves, right? And to leave that decision in the hands of those individual gun owners and not the state. Right now, though, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Kansas where a man sentenced to 18 months in prison for a shooting at a motel in Lawrence in 2023. As part of the plea deal, the state agreed to ignore the fact that a gun was used. And even though, again, he's convicted of a shooting, we'll pay no attention to that. Now, I will say it could be worse. Because under the terms of this plea deal, Evan Hefner, who's 20 years old, could have been released to nothing more than probation. A judge did send him to prison or ordered him to go to prison for 18 months. Now with time off for good behavior, maybe even time off for good sir, for a time spent behind bars waiting trial. Hefner is not going to do 18 months, but he's not going to walk away immediately on probation either. He was convicted back in September on one felony count of aggravated battery. He was originally charged with first-degree attempted murder for shooting at a 38-year-old man named Harlan Epps on May 10th, 2023 at a Motel 6 in Lawrence. Epps was struck in the arm by one of the rounds that was fired by Hefner. A plea deal reduced the charge to battery, and the state did not ask the court to find that a gun was used in the crime. If that did not happen, then there would have been a mandatory prison sentence attached to this. But Judge Stacey Donovan had the discretion to grant Hefner probation or to send him to prison. She rejected Hefner's request for probation, again, sentencing him to 18 months in prison. But she did reduce his 3-year prison sentence in half, saying the actions you took were dangerous and could have been deadly. Hefner's attorney, according to the Lawrence Journal-World, had asked the court to grant Hefner probation because he was only 18 at the time of the incident. He had only been convicted of misdemeanor crimes in the past, and he was struggling with meth addiction since the incident. None of which, by the way, to me, seem to be mitigating factors. If you're 18, you're an adult. If you're again, I believe that 18-year-olds possess the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms because they're adults. So an 18-year-old who engages in a criminal act, you're an adult. Oh, well, he only had misdemeanor crimes in his past. Okay. Most people don't even have that at age 18, right? And the fact that Hefner has been struggling with a addiction to methamphetamine since the shooting, to me, is frankly all the more reason to ensure that there was some sort of custodial sentence that may give him the opportunity to get treatment for that addiction behind bars. In fact, his own attorney noted that Hefner had been kicked out of a rehab facility in December last month, but was, quote, working to get a bed in another facility. Well, now he's got a chance, I guess, because a bed has been available for him, made available for him for theoretically 18 months or so. But we'll see what happens. I hope that Mr. Hefner takes advantage of the leniency that has been given him. But I have to say, I'm not all that optimistic that that's going to be the case. All right, today's Armed Citizen story from Tennessee. Now, this headline completely misses the point here. Grocery store manager shoots getaway driver helping accused shoplifters, Tennessee cops say. All right, so shooting at shoplifters or even shooting at a getaway driver if someone is shoplifting, that's likely to get you arrested, right? Shoplifting is a crime, but it is not generally a threat to your life. It is not something that generally leads to grievous bodily harm or death. So responding to shoplifting with deadly force, that's likely to end up poorly for the individual involved. But that is not actually what happened here, despite the headline. This happened in Shelby County, Tennessee. guy named Robbie Wooten, a guy named Dustin Foles are both facing charges of aggravated assault and theft under $1,000. Wooten, who's 33, is also accused of being a felon in possession of a firearm, and the 22-year-old Foles is facing an additional robbery charge. Now, according to Memphis police, Foles and two 17-year-olds entered a grocery store, loaded up a car with food, and then walked out without paying on the morning of January the 10th. The manager of the grocery store told police that he followed the trio out of the door, and he grabbed the cart as they tried to get into a gray van that was driven by a man later identified as Wooten. Wooten is then accused of getting out of the van with a gun, threatening to kill the manager with said gun, and then firing a round into the air. So this has now gone beyond simple shoplifting. Right now, the manager does have a justified fear for his life. He's got an armed guy who's threatened to kill him. And the manager said he fell to the ground because his leg gave out, but he pulled out his own gun and shot at Wooten. Foles allegedly intervened and tried to take the manager's gun, but the manager fought him off until the suspects drove away in a van, according to Memphis police. Manager said he did recover the shopping cart with about $200 worth of food. Officers said that they received another call reporting a shooting about a mile away. That's where they found Wooten with a gunshot wound. He was hospitalized in critical condition. Wooten was convicted of kidnapping, by the way, in 2018. So not long ago. It's unclear how much time, if any time, he spent behind bars for that crime. The two teenagers are also facing charges of aggravated assault, acting in concert, and theft under $1,000. The grocery store manager not facing any charges because, again, he was acting in self-defense, despite what the headline makes it sound like. And finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing able to do the right thing. An Arizonan who helped a truck driver after his semi became engulfed in flames. You can see there is not much left of that truck. I mean, that is a very scary situation. Happened on Monday morning on US 93 near Wickenburg. William Rubio said he was heading towards the valley for work when he saw the flames. He said it was bad. I think he would have burned to death in like less than a minute. Said he was coming around a bend and he saw the truck sideswipe another semi-truck, sending that second semi-truck into a parked RV. Rubio said from what people are saying, the RV had been parked there for 3 days. His truck caught fire and literally he was stuck and pinned underneath his steering wheel. So Rubio jumped out of his truck, ran over, managed to get the door open, pulled the driver out of the semi. Rubio said, "You're putting yourself in danger, I guess, but wouldn't you want someone to do that for you?" That driver, Ed Moorhead, says that Rubio saved his life. He said he has head injuries, his body's in pain, but he too believes he would not be here today were it not for the actions of Mr. Rubio. He said, I knew I didn't have much time, and thank God for Will. So again, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing for a stranger in need, William Rubio, we thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is all the time we've got for you on this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. Do want to encourage you to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. And if you like what you see, I also encourage you to become a VIP or VIP Gold member. You get exclusive content, including the ability to join our weekly VIP Gold live chat every Wednesday at 1:30 Eastern. And you'll be supporting the independent pro Second Amendment journalism that we do at Bearing Arms. So thank you again for all of your support, both for the website and for me personally. I really do appreciate it. I've had a lot of folks reach out saying they're keeping me and my family in their prayers. And you know what? We still need them. So thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your hump day Wednesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe. Be free. And make stuff.